Hi, this is Alan Chartok. On today's very special program, we'll be talking to Dr. Paul Lemansky, who is an internist with an incredible interest in preventative medicine. He's part of one of the largest groups of cardiologists in the Capital Region area, Prime Care Physicians, where he's the director of the Center for Preventative Medicine. He came to me because I wrote an article not long ago complaining about my cholesterol numbers, which would not go down, and where I was having a lot of problems keeping the ratio between the good HDL cholesterol and the bad LDL cholesterol in some kind of semblance that would prevent my having a eventual heart attack. And that's the way that I saw it. So I wrote an article about politics, and somebody sent me Dr. Lemansky's name, and I've been talking to him ever since. And I have to tell you, he knows more about this stuff than anybody that you'll ever want to talk to. And the great thing about him is he can cite you chapter and verse as to what you should do to save your own life. Now, listen up, folks, because here we go. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Alan.
Paul, what got you interested in all of this in the first place?
Well, I think heart disease is the number one killer in the United States. And what I think is most interesting is that it really is a disease that afflicts the people of the United States because of everything that we do have. It's actually a problem of Western culture. Therefore, I believe that Americans need a new approach to the management of cardiovascular disease. We have wonderful acute interventions. We have excellent drugs and medications. But in addition to that, I believe we have to come up with a new lifestyle approach to the treatment of cardiovascular disease to complement those other excellent approaches. I like to say that we currently live in a society where food is in excess, yet our genetics, which were established 100,000 years ago, were done in a circumstance of relative scarcity of food. As a consequence, this additional weight that all of us have to struggle with puts our biochemistry in complete disarray and results in progressive deposition of cholesterol into the artery walls, giving us the problems that we're all aware of, heart disease and stroke. The new National Cholesterol Education Program guidelines are excellent in that they address across the board both the bad cholesterol and, as you were mentioning, the good cholesterol as well. That's very important because previously, although good cholesterol had been used to assess one's risk,
and we called that good cholesterol HDL.
HDL. We had never really used it to treat the problem. Because of studies published in the last few years now, we know that getting the good cholesterol up is extremely beneficial. And along with that, getting the triglycerides to come down.
And triglycerides are?
They're the storage form of fat. And if you have a roll around your middle, and most of us do, that's triglyceride. And some of it can actually get out into the bloodstream. And it is a marker for risk. Now, what's interesting, and I think what puts the power back into the individual's hand with regard to their own health, is that we very much can control the HDL and the triglycerides, how we live our lives, and the types of foods we eat. And that will dramatically complement our physicians giving us medications to lower the bad cholesterol. So it's a combination of lowering the bad cholesterol by both diet and lifestyle and medication, and raising the good cholesterol with first lifestyle and diet, and also there are some medications that will raise the good cholesterol.
Okay. Don't you dare out there turn off your radio right now because you don't want to hear this, because as Dr. Lemansky is pointing out, it's on you. And it's very important that we talk about this now so that everybody gets an idea what to do to save their own life. Paul, let me go back and ask you this. What do we know about societies and what they eat?
Well, that's an excellent question, Alan. In America, we eat everything. And I think if you look at the fast foods that we consume, if you look at the size of the portions that we eat in restaurants, even when the food is perfectly fine, but the amounts are excessive, Americans eat a fair amount of saturated fat, less so perhaps than we did. We eat a large amount of carbohydrate, thus the dramatic rise in weight and the corresponding rise in diabetes. In the last 8 years, there's been a 30% increase in diabetes.
Say that again. In the last
8 years, there's been a 30% increase in diabetes, in large part fueled by weight.
I want everybody to be on the same page here, Paul. So saturated fat is?
Saturated fat is the fat that you basically get from consuming animal products. So if you're eating a steak, we all know what the fat looks like on a steak, but we don't always appreciate that there may be marbling of that steak. That's saturated fat as well. So you're not going to get saturated fat unless you're eating an animal product, with the possible exception of certain types of coconut oil, as an example, palm oil. Those are the two types of vegetable fats that have high levels of saturated fat.
That would be coconut and palm.
That's
correct. If you're taking notes, go ahead.
Now, in other societies in the world, we see different types of fats consumed and a generally different diet where the rates of heart disease are dramatically lower. And I would turn your attention to the Mediterranean basin. We've known for a long time in epidemiologic, and those are population studies, that the people in the Mediterranean basin have low rates of cardiovascular disease. We also know that within certain countries within the Mediterranean basin, the rates are very low. And Crete is an example of a place on the planet that has an extremely low rate of cardiovascular disease. This has been looked at by researchers, and the feeling is that it not only is a benefit of the so-called Mediterranean diet, that is, where the majority of your fat calories come from olive oil or canola oil, and you eat vegetables and some fruits and small amounts of meat and fish.
So let me stop. Good, canola oil and olive oil.
Yes, good. Good because they contain monounsaturated fat, which tends to not raise the bad cholesterol, tends to hold the good cholesterol up, tends to be, at least both in the epidemiologic, that is the population studies that are done looking at various countries, certainly does no harm. And actually in controlled clinical trials, which is the standard of medicine, can be shown when compared to a normal Western diet to reduce the rate of cardiovascular disease dramatically. Take the example of the Lyon Diet Heart Study. Lyon is a city in France where the study was run, and this was published in the journal Circulation, so it's a very prestigious cardiovascular journal in the world. The study showed that individuals who ate a Mediterranean diet containing a fair amount of omega-3 fatty acid, again, this is based on the Cretan diet, as compared to folks eating a French diet. Now, Americans may think that a French diet is worse than ours, but in actuality, with regard to the amount of saturated fat that's consumed, the French diet actually is superior to the American diet, and Frenchmen have lower rates of cardiovascular disease on average.
Well, they have a lot of creams and stuff.
They do. They do. And it's always been called the French paradox. How can they get away with eating these creams and rich foods and still have lower rates of cardiovascular disease than we do? But when one looks at the Frenchmen as compared to Frenchmen who were given a Mediterranean diet high in omega-3, you found a reduction in cardiovascular death of, Alan, 70%. 70%. Now, if one compared that in some future study to an actual American diet, one could actually expect an even greater reduction.
So let's go back here, just because I've just got to understand this. The omega-3 fats are prevalent in the French diet, right?
No, they're actually prevalent in certain Mediterranean countries, specifically Crete.
But what about France?
Well, I think the French probably do eat more omega-3s than we do. Okay. This specific study was looking at maximizing the amount of omega-3 in the diet of the folks in the experimental portion as compared to the typical French Western diet.
Okay. So omega-3 fats on the island of Crete, we think, keep people's good cholesterol up, bad cholesterol down.
Actually, it's interesting that when one compared the cholesterols in the Lyon Diet Heart Study, both the control group compared to the experimental group, the total cholesterol was the same. Mm-hmm. The HDL cholesterol was the same in the two groups. The LDL cholesterol was the same.
Mm.
So there's some mechanism beyond simply where your cholesterol lies that contributes to reduction in death.
So we could go around thinking that high cholesterol is bad, but according to this study, even though the cholesterols were the same, more people were dying here than were dying in Crete. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct. So, I mean, there's no question that lowering cholesterol, specifically LDL cholesterol, improves outcome. That is, it decreases death rates, it decreases heart attacks. Mm-hmm. There's no question that raising HDL is helpful. But what we're saying here is this, that cholesterol is not the only thing. And we can actually make changes in the diet that contribute to further reduced risk above the benefits that we get with the medications we take and the approach we take with lowering the bad cholesterol and raising the good cholesterol.
Okay, so if you want to save your life, go live on Crete. But if you don't go to Crete, is there another place you could go which also has the same obvious dietary benefits?
Yes, actually, that place would be in Okinawa, of all places. And what's interesting is that the blood chemistry of individuals who live in Okinawa. Now, remember, these folks live on the other side of the planet. They eat a totally different diet, okay? And they're genetically different from Cretans.
Uh-huh.
Yet, their blood chemistry, in terms of the fatty acid composition, looks almost identical to the Cretans. And it's interesting to note, they have an equally low rate of cardiovascular disease. Now, the Cretans get it from eating walnuts and a vegetable called purslane. The Okinawans get it from the consumption of canola oil.
Okay, let's stop right there. For those people who are looking for tips on how to get their HDL up, their LDL down, one of the things we want to do is to go to the health food store and get ourselves some walnuts, right? Isn't it?
Well, here's what I would suggest. We're Americans. We're not Cretans and we're not Okinawans.
Right.
And there are ways that we can accomplish the types of outcomes that would occur in a Mediterranean diet in ways that are acceptable to Americans. And I think, you know, if a person has diverticuli, diverticulosis, you know, sometimes eating walnuts is not a great thing because
they get stuck in those little pouches.
They get stuck in those little pouches and cause inflammation, infection, etc. We do know that, for example, if you use canola oil has the omega-3 fatty acid in it that the walnut does.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, in actuality, in the Lyon diet study that was done that I mentioned, the Frenchmen did not want to really use olive oil all the time. And so one of the ways that they improved the fatty acid composition of the Frenchmen's blood was to give them a canola oil spread. So in other words, their margarine was canola oil margarine.
Hmm.
Okay, and that's how they increased the omega-3s in the Frenchmen. So the idea here would be that the majority of your fat calories should come from olive oil and some from canola oil over saturated fat that you'd find in meat.
But I find this very interesting. Why do you say if the canola oil has positive properties and is active in this cholesterol problem of mine, why do you say use olive oil, which is sort of neutral, as opposed to canola oil, which has positive aspects to it?
Well, you know, I mean, we try and get a balance. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Olive oil tends to have certain properties of when you put olive oil on a salad,
mm-hmm.
the taste is superior to the perception of most individuals as compared to canola oil.
Mm-hmm.
Olive oil has a lower smoking temperature, so perhaps mm-hmm. for cooking purposes, if you were spraying your pan with an oil prior to the preparation of a meal, if you use canola oil, that may be a better approach. And, you know, if you were using a salad, olive oil would be a better approach. I don't think one necessarily, you know, should take the place exclusively of the other. I think, again, we're looking for a balance. But most importantly, what we're not consuming is other types of fat. I have to emphasize, Alan, that it is not simply the addition of either olive oil or canola oil to the diet that's felt to get benefit.
Mm.
It's the substitution. You can't take a triple cheeseburger and pour olive oil on it and feel you're going to get the benefit, okay? It is the substitution, not only for saturated fat, but also for polyunsaturated fats, okay? The omega-6 polyunsaturated fats, such as corn oil, are probably not in the same league, do not have the benefit that we see for the omega-3s and olive oil. And if Americans can incorporate more of olive oil and canola oil into their diets in a judicious way, and decrease the amount of saturated fat, both from meat and, you know, when people fry things in saturated fat, obviously that's not good. We know that is the case. If that can be done and decrease polyunsaturates as well, we believe that there will be a substantial benefit, as one sees in these both the controlled clinical trials and in the epidemiological population studies looking at various countries in the world.
Well, you know, the problem I have with you, Doc, is that I suspect you're being too reasonable. Now, you see, to me, when you say something like that, meat bad, don't eat meat. But you're saying, hey, I got to deal with the whole population out here, and I know they're not going to lay off the meat altogether. So I have to approach this, as you use the word, judiciously. Is that right?
That's correct.
But are you a vegetarian?
No.
Uh-huh.
I'm not. My primary personal protein source is fish.
Mine too.
Okay. Now, that being said, I do eat chicken breast, and occasionally I will eat red meat. I don't believe that one needs to completely exclude the types of foods that are out there out of your diet forever. What happens is that we tend to eat to excess of a certain type of food.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if one were to say how many times a week or a month should one have red meat, I would say probably 1 to 2 times a month,
mm-hmm.
to maybe 4 times a month eating red meat.
Depending on your personality.
Depending on
my personality is I don't eat any meat ever.
Right.
But I know the day I eat that first piece of roast beef, I'll be having it 5 times a week.
Well,
so I know my personality.
Which is why I recommend to my patients, Alan, that if they want to eat red meat, they only eat filet mignon. And the reason for that is twofold. The first reason is it's very lean. And the second reason is it's very expensive. So you can't eat very much of it. So if you basically say to yourself, I'm just going to eat red meat and you eat filet mignon, great. You're going to eat it with the proper frequency. Most people will.
Okay. So that is one level of disagreement. For those of us who are compulsive personalities and who have to gourmand on everything, I take away from what you're saying is use olive oil or use canola oil to cook because, as you say, the temperature at which you can use canola oil is much hotter. Okay. I accept that. But I don't accept that I should use it, you know, judiciously as opposed to the other stuff, because why would I use the other stuff at all if I know it's going to kill me?
Well, certainly every person can make the decision as to how best they are. I have some patients who say, if I start eating X, I'll want to eat it all the time.
Right.
To those individuals, right. If you know yourself, to those individuals, I say, don't eat X.
Yeah.
So if you don't want to eat meat, nobody's forcing you, don't do so.
Mm-hmm.
If it makes it easier for you and your life is fulfilled doing what you're doing, that's perfectly fine.
Is there any chemical property by eating meat that actually helps us in terms of our hearts?
I don't know the answer to that question. Certainly, I'll tell you this. You know, I mean, any type of meat product has benefit for the body, okay? The problem is in the amount that we consume, not in what it has within it. Even saturated fat has its place. The most difficult thing to teach people is moderation. What I would suggest is that if one looked at the type of a diet that would help and yield a type of a moderation, it would be a Mediterranean diet. Mediterranean diets do not exclude meat. They do not exclude red meat. They place the red meat in a certain frequency context that makes it acceptable and, you know, is the type of thing that...
quite frequently, it could be a garnish as opposed to...
That's correct. I mean, in America, we tend to eat a big piece of meat on a plate and small amounts of vegetables instead of the other way around. That's not necessarily to our benefit.
What kills more people, smoking or the consumption of animal fats?
Well, first of all, there's no benefit to smoking small amounts. Okay, tobacco is not beneficial to the human body. You stop smoking, you get a 50% reduction in your risk for cardiovascular death. That's been proved, and I think it makes no sense to consume tobacco in even small amounts. The same does not hold true for saturated fat, and the same does not hold true for red meat. Those have a place within the diet. The issue is knowing yourself and coming up with the type of a diet that allows you to have the lowest possible risk and still enjoy yourself. We believe that a Mediterranean diet, and I say by we, I think medicine is moving in the direction of feeling that a Mediterranean diet or some variation, as you see in Crete, a high omega-3 Mediterranean diet, that variation probably brings with it much more benefit and for the great majority of individuals. We also know, I mean, it's not just a 5-year clinical trial here that shows this. We have 5,000 years of looking in the Mediterranean basin. Not only is this healthful, it is something that people can enjoy, food that can be consumed in a way that is a complex diet, an interesting diet, something that's, you know, a joy to eat.
There's somebody out there who's listening to us right now who is saying, Baloney. This is all genetics. Don't you understand, Doc, that on Okinawa and in Crete, they got a genetic pattern, which is why they live longer. It has nothing to do with their cholesterol.
Well, you know, that's true. There are genetic predispositions to disease. I will tell you, however, that if you look at Japanese as a whole,
sure,
that in the last 20 or years or so, they, when you look at their diet and you look at their risk for cardiovascular disease, it's quite low. However, when Japanese migrate to Hawaii, their cholesterol goes up and their risk goes up because they're eating something closer to what's consumed on the mainland. When they finally migrate to the LA Basin, as an example, mm-hmm. and frequent our fast food restaurants and start to eat a truly Western diet as we do in the States, their rates of cardiovascular disease approach those of other ethnic groups. So it is not genetics. And as a matter of fact, if one looked at the average world cholesterol, it's about 140. It is not 210 or 215, which is where Americans lie. We're the crossroads of the world. We have people from all over the planet. It is the diet we consume for 98 to 99% of the folks that causes our problem and the excess calories that we take in. It is not the genetics. It is true for some, but it is not true for the majority.
We're talking to Dr. Paul Lemansky, director of the Center for Preventative Medicine, Albany Associates in Cardiology, and Prime Care Physicians in Albany, New York. Talk to me about fat. I don't mean fat that we consume. I mean fat on our bodies.
Very, very, very important issue. As I said before, I like to say that our genetics was defined in a period of relative scarcity of food. At this juncture, our society has evolved to the point where it can supply everybody with food, indeed meat, three times a day if you want. The problem is that this relative excess, this 30-pound extra that a lot of us carry, throws the biochemistry of the body into disarray. The additional weight contributes to diabetes, which speeds the laying down of plaque in the body. The additional weight increases the bad cholesterol. It decreases the good cholesterol. It increases the triglycerides. If there were one thing that Americans could do and have within their power to do to reduce their risk, it would be to bring their body weight down to what it was, you know, when they were 20 or 25 years old.
So the very act of putting on weight adds to heart disease.
Absolutely.
And to diabetes?
Absolutely.
So why in the world should anybody, I hate to say this, I'll probably get sued for it, but why in the world should anybody ever go into McDonald's?
Well, again, you know, it's an issue of the frequency. I guess if you bring your kids in once a month, you know, that's one thing. If you're driving through the drive-thru on a daily basis, that's not good. And the problem for our society is that we all have such busy lives that diet, cooking, and health sometimes take a back seat to everything else. That's unfortunate because it has dramatic consequence over time.
So if you want to save your life, one of the things, we've talked about canola oil and olive oil and not eating saturated fat, but to just go over this one more time, you would want to keep your weight down.
Absolutely. You'd want to keep your weight down, and you'd want to keep your weight down over a long period of time if you're 30 or 50 pounds overweight. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you can do to reduce your risk is to reduce your weight. Now, even within our own group at Albany Associates in Cardiology and Prime Care, we have recognized the importance of weight reduction for reducing risk. We actually run a weight reduction program to reduce body weight because of the dramatic benefit. It supercharges medicine when you lose 20, 25 pounds. And triglycerides can drop 1,000 points.
Yeah.
It's very, very, very powerful. And I would add, being an individual who spends a lot of my day trying to achieve for my patients the National Cholesterol Education Program guidelines using medication, it's not always so simple to reach the recommended targets with medication alone. 20 to 25 pounds of weight loss can do a tremendous amount to improve the ability of your doctor to help you to get those triglycerides, the HDL, the LDL, to the targets we know will give you the lowest possible risk.
You're listening to, let's just call it, How to Save Your Life with Dr. Paul Lemansky, who is, as he has just mentioned, an internist with Prime Care Physicians and the Center for Preventive Medicine at Prime Care Physicians and Albany Cardiology Group. Now, let's go on. I'm going to name a word, and then I want you to react to it, okay? Statins.
Antidotes for Western civilization. Statins are probably, in the last 10 years, from a cardiovascular perspective, the drug that has done the most to reduce the risk for cardiovascular disease in the United States. And in the last 3 years, we have some evidence that statins work not simply by lowering the bad cholesterol, which is what we believe they did before, and they do that quite well. They also work by decreasing inflammation in the arteries of the body. Now, we believe that the inflammation comes from the deposition of cholesterol into the artery wall. It's not supposed to be there. Inflammation is the body's reaction to that. That is, white blood cells, the ones that normally fight infection in your body, actually go after the plaque, knowing it's not supposed to be in the artery wall, and attack it. That process causes the plaque to become unstable. That instability can lead to a crack in the plaque, and then a subsequent blood clot forming on top of the crack. And it's the blood clot, actually, not the plaque so much, but the blood clot that forms on top of an unstable plaque that stops the flow of blood downstream through the artery and can cause a heart attack or a stroke.
So, I was going to give you this word, but I'm going to give it to you now. You used it, but I want a little bit more of an explanation. Inflammation.
Right.
Now, we know, let me just ask you this. We know that for years, anybody who took an, 81 milligram aspirin had a lower risk by a lot of a heart attack than somebody who didn't take that aspirin.
Right.
Now, how does that fit into all of this inflammation?
That's a very good question. First of all, the general reduction in risk is about 25% relative risk reduction from aspirin. Paul Ritger from Harvard has been looking at the inflammatory aspect of atherosclerosis, of plaque in the arteries, and how that contributes to heart attacks. And what he's been able to do is to come up with a test to measure inflammation. And that test is called a high-sensitivity C-reactive protein.
This is available to people now?
It's available to all physicians in the capital area. It's done by a number of them. LabCorp, Quest, all the lab vendors generally have this test. It's an inexpensive test. It costs about $30. And it gives a tremendous amount of information. Paul Ritger showed that if you had a population of patients and broke that population up into four groups, so you have the patients with the lowest inflammatory marker, the hsCRP, the patients with the highest, and then patients in between. If you were in the highest category and you took an aspirin, you reduced your risk for a heart attack by not 25%, but 68%. And if you were in the very lowest category of inflammation, that didn't really do very much. So when we talk about a 25% relative risk reduction, we're talking about for all comers. But if you actually use the test to stratify risk, you could determine who were the people that would get the most benefit. This becomes important, for example, in primary prevention. I mean, usually doctors will not recommend everybody go on aspirin. They recommend if you've had a heart attack or a problem like that, problem with atherosclerosis, that maybe you should use an aspirin. But in primary prevention, it's not generally been a recommendation because aspirin has risk. You can have a GI bleed, that is, you can bleed from your stomach, you can bleed in your brain, you can get into an accident, and if you're on aspirin, you may bleed to death, whereas otherwise you wouldn't. So aspirin has some risk associated with its use, and therefore one wouldn't prudently say to the entire population, everybody take an aspirin. If one uses the hsCRP test, however, you can see that some folks in what we call primary prevention who have no real manifest disease can actually reduce their risk dramatically. It's interesting because we had previously thought that aspirin worked by reducing the stickiness of platelets. Those are the corpuscles in the blood that plug holes. Okay, it may turn out, and indeed looks to be turning out, that aspirin works by two different mechanisms in protecting us against heart disease. One of the things is it makes our platelets less sticky, but also it decreases inflammation and makes it probably less likely that our plaque cracks.
So that makes me ask you a question. You did a test on me, didn't you?
Yes.
And you found out that I was in the lowest potential inflammation group. And I've been taking an aspirin a day forever, just like a lot of doctors I know.
That's right.
Okay, because I think that the heart thing is better for me than the risk of the bleeding possibilities. However, how do we know that the reason that I'm in that lowest inflammation group isn't that I've been taking the aspirin all along?
Well, we wouldn't unless we took you off the aspirin to find out. But what we can say is, because there are some folks, for example, who will take aspirin, their inflammation is still high. It's less high than it would have been, but it's still elevated. You know, what we could say is that, you know, you may not be getting as much benefit as somebody with a lot of inflammation, but you probably would still get the antiplatelet stickiness benefit of aspirin. And, you know, that's not inconsequential. It's just that this is a way of trying to better understand and better decide who would benefit most.
Now, the drug companies, of course, are making out like bandits over all these statins and everything. I heard talked to a doctor one day who said to me, if he had his way, he'd put statins in the water supply because they're so effective.
Well, luckily, only one statin is water-soluble, so that wouldn't generally work very well.
But,
you know, one can't underemphasize, Alan, the benefits of these drugs in our culture. Okay, and I, as somebody who gives medication out, I'm always going to be suspect, I guess. However, the reduction in risk of taking a statin is on the order of 30 to 40% for a heart attack, for a stroke. These are not small reductions in risk, yet the risk of actually taking the medication is extremely small. So we get tremendous benefit at very low risk, and I think that's a fairly good deal, and that's why the drugs are used by clinicians as much as they are. What I want to emphasize, though, is that while we can use those drugs to lower the bad cholesterol, we need to start thinking about, remember, these are 30 and 40% reductions. They're not 100% reductions. That we need to start looking at the HDL and the triglycerides as the next step to address in reducing risk.
Okay, let's go there.
Well, there's a study out recently, October of this past year, by Dr. Greg Brown, who's at the University of Washington in Seattle. And the study was called the HATS trial. And what HATS looked at was, what was the benefit of raising HDL in individuals who were already on a statin? Could additional benefit be shown? Now, the news media, interestingly, looked only at one specific aspect of this study. And you can probably remember several months back, there was a study that came out and made a splash across the papers and on the news, which basically said that antioxidants were not beneficial and actually hurt some folks who were on statins.
Uh-huh.
Now, what is interesting about the HATS trial is that HATS looked at a drug with a statin, then a niacin, and then it also had an antioxidant arm. The antioxidant cocktail that was used was vitamin E, vitamin C, selenium, and beta carotene. So it was a bunch. One can't attribute the changes to simply one of the antioxidants. But what was shown was that if you took the statin plus the niacin, this was as given by your doctor, not something you bought yourself, but as given by your doctor, that you could reduce a what we call a composite endpoint. So they looked at stroke and heart attack, both fatal and non-fatal, and the need for a bypass. That was reduced a dramatic 90%. 90%. Okay, we're talking a dramatic reduction here, and yet...
Say that again. Let's make sure everybody understands. First of all, I think we may have skipped over one thing. It was one of those words I was going to give you, which was niacin.
Niacin. Niacin is a vitamin.
Right.
Okay, but doctors give this vitamin in very large amounts, what it would otherwise be called megavitamin dosing. Okay, so you may take 1,000 or 1,500 or 2,000 milligrams of niacin. That vitamin, in used as a drug, raises the good cholesterol, lowers the triglycerides, and to some extent lowers the bad cholesterol as well. It complements, okay, in this particular study, the statin. So the statin works by lowering the bad cholesterol primarily.
But what I'm also hearing here is, if you're doing that and you take a lot of vitamins as I do, because of their antioxidant properties, this study that you're citing suggests maybe that's not such a good thing.
Yes, well, it raises that concern. Because when one looked at the folks who were just on the statin plus the niacin,
right,
okay, those folks had a 90% reduction in, you know, this composite endpoint. And yet...
Which the composite endpoint
Well, we're
of...
looking at strokes and heart attacks,
right,
both fatal and non-fatal, so they lumped it all together.
Right. Not,
but a 90% reduction in these clinical events is dramatic. It's dramatic. And if one looked at the folks who got the statin and the niacin plus the antioxidants...
They didn't do as well.
They didn't do as well. They still did better than people who didn't get the simvastatin and niacin, so they did better than just the antioxidant group. But they got about a 60% reduction, not a 90% reduction. And when Dr. Brown looked at it, he found out because there seemed to be something in the antioxidant cocktail that reduced the cholesterol, the HDL-2B. That's the HDL portion. HDL actually comes in several different particles. The particle that causes...
HDL, for those who are just joining in, are the good cholesterol.
Yes. And that is the cholesterol, actually, that acts like a vacuum cleaner. It goes to the plaque, picks up the bad cholesterol, and brings it back to the liver.
You're listening to Dr. Paul Lemansky, who could save your life if you just listen. So far, we've learned a lot. Lose the weight. Use the proper oils, olive oil or canola oil. Do not engorge yourself with meats. You can have it sometime, according to Dr. Lemansky, but according to political scientist Dr. Shartak, you should have it never. And Dr. Lemansky is with Prime Care Physicians in our area and is the director for the Center for Preventative Medicine. And I'm finding this one of the most fascinating conversations from a personal point of view that I've ever had. And now I've learned, don't take a lot of vitamins if you're going to take the niacin and the statins in order to lower your cholesterol and raise your HDL.
And what I would say is that it's still, you know, not completely understood which one of those antioxidants potentially made the benefit less. It's not understood. Does that mean one should shy away from all antioxidants? I don't know. I mean, there are several large clinical trials looking at vitamin E. By clinical trials, we mean, you know, patients put into two groups. Mm. They're randomized to either the medication or to placebo, a sugar pill. Doesn't show that vitamin E, at least with regard to the heart, benefits significantly. So it's somewhat difficult to know exactly what recommendations to make to people with regard to antioxidants. I tend to prefer and to suggest that insofar as one is able, if you can get your antioxidants from the foods that you consume, that that is the best way to get them. Remember, antioxidants sometimes travel in groups. They travel with other complex phytochemicals, and we don't know that any specific isolated antioxidant will get you the benefit that we see in the epidemiology, the population studies of folks who eat lots of vegetables and fruits.
White rice versus brown rice?
Well, I think, you know, most of the time the recommendation is to eat those foods that are the least processed. And brown rice would be superior in that regard to white rice. We try to also recommend that carbohydrate itself be not excessive. And I think that in the last few years where the concern has been eat low fat, eat low fat, eat low fat, that the food industry has responded by decreasing the amount of fat in cakes, for example, that you can buy in the store. And as a consequence of decreasing that, they've got to put something in it. So they put sugar or carbohydrate, with the result that Americans have taken in a lot more sugar and carbohydrate in the last 15 or 20 years. And we believe that that's what's contributed so substantially to the weight gain. I would also add that folks should know that even if they're eating a no-fat cake, that the no-fat is determined by the size of the portion. And the cake is going to have some fat in it. So if you eat the whole cake thinking you're getting absolutely no fat, not so.
We're talking to Dr. Paul Lemansky, director of the Center for Preventative Medicine, Albany Associates in Cardiology, and Prime Care Physicians in Albany, New York. Talk to me about this niacin thing. I'm fascinated by that. Didn't I hear somewhere that you could get flushed by taking this thing?
Absolutely. First of all, I want to emphasize that niacin, the way we're talking about it, is being used as a drug. Okay, we're using it in what's called pharmacologic amounts. This is not what the minimum daily requirement of niacin is. Niacin used in large amounts can affect the liver, so it's something that should be done by your physician. Okay? It shouldn't be something that you self-medicate with. However, we do know that this particular vitamin can do very beneficial things to the lipid profile. By that I mean, as I had said, the good cholesterol will drop a bit, the HDL will go up tremendously. It go up by more than any other drug that's out there. And the triglycerides will also be brought down. So niacin has an excellent place in the physician's armamentarium of cholesterol-lowering and cholesterol-improving drugs. There are also clinical trials with niacin going back into the 1980s with the Coronary Drug Project that show definitively reductions in events, heart attacks, deaths with the drug. So I think there's enough evidence to say that niacin is good for reducing cardiovascular risk. The issue is how much to use, and that really is something that should be decided between a patient and their physician.
Is there a downside to niacin?
Well, it can cause elevations in uric acid. So if you're predisposed to gout, as an example, and you go on a large amount of niacin, it can increase your uric acid and give you a gouty attack, or worse, a kidney stone. In individuals who have ulcer disease that's ongoing, it can increase acid secretion in the stomach and cause, there's a relative contraindication to using niacin in that circumstance. For the majority of patients, if you're going through your doctor in terms of asking whether niacin would be of benefit for you, and that's what I would recommend to most people, those simple tests can be measured and your doctor can tell you whether or not the niacin would be, you know, contraindicated or not. And there are, of course, side effects from the use of the niacin for some folks, and those side effects might be flushing. So it's like you get, after consuming, taking the pill, you may feel like a sunburn. Actually, your skin can get red. And that usually will go away with continued use, but it can be very frightening for someone who's not aware of that side effect. And again, that's one of the reasons why we recommend that if one is going to be using niacin as a drug for cholesterol, it really has to be done by a physician and in a judicious way.
So the combination that we're looking for here right now to raise the HDL is the statin, which would be, what, Provacol or some of these others, and the niacin, potentially, if it's not counterindicated because you have ulcers or other things.
Yeah, just to correct you, the statin is going to reduce the LDL. It generally doesn't have a big HDL-raising effect.
I see.
However, the niacin does it. That's why they're complementary. Now, what I would like to point out to your listeners is for every milligram that you lower the LDL, you lower your risk by 1%. So if you drop your LDL by 20 points, that's 20% reduction in risk.
But what if your HDL rides down lower at the same time that the LDL?
Well, you'd have to calculate every milligram that your HDL goes up.
Yeah.
Okay, you reduce your risk by 3%. Conversely, if your HDL drops, your risk goes up by 3%. By using the two calculations together, you can determine your overall relative risk reduction over time. So you can find out if you reduce your risk 50%, 80%, 90%, that can be looked at. Your doctor knows these things. I mean, these are things that have been published in the recent literature. And it gives us a way of quantitating the benefit of taking these particular agents. And I think that that's beneficial.
Talk to me about exercise, Dr. Paul Lemansky.
Exercise, absolutely critical. And it doesn't have to be, you know, doesn't have to be at a health club. It can be simply walking. Exercise helps us not only in raising the good cholesterol, it actually, even in the absence of weight loss, will help lower triglycerides. Remember, again, we're addressing the HDL and the triglycerides now because LDL has been, to some extent, very well addressed by the use of statins. But exercise is absolutely instrumental in raising good cholesterol, lowering triglycerides, and it is the most important thing that one can do to control one's weight.
How much exercise?
Well, you know, I think recommendations range from 30 minutes a day to 60 minutes a day. And there's some, you know, disagreement as to the level of exercise. I would say if someone had heart disease and or they knew they were at risk, that they should ask their clinician as to how much exercise is enough. If they're not, then, you know, generally speaking, walking and starting out, you know, 5 minutes the first day, every other day, and then maybe going to every day, and then 10 minutes, and walking every day, or even parking a little farther away in a parking lot, getting a little bit of exercise in the activities of daily living can dramatically improve your ability to control your weight. Remember, exercise does not need to be, for weight reduction purposes, does not need to be done contiguously. That is, you don't have to do 30 straight minutes or 60 straight minutes. You do 5 minutes here, 4 minutes there, 3 minutes here, 2 minutes there. You're burning calories when you walk. It pays for us as Americans to know that walking is something that you don't need a lot of expensive equipment for. If you do it in a way where you can talk while you walk, that's generally going to be safe. But if you have a risk for heart disease, you've been told you have heart problems, that's something best discussed with your doctor.
What's the relationship, if any, of calcium to heart disease?
Well, calcium does have very complex interactions in the human body and in the heart and in smooth muscle. And I will point out that one of the recommendations that we make at Center for Preventive Medicine, and we have dietitians that help folks to alter diet, that one of the dietary changes, for example, to control blood pressure, is an alteration that not only reduces saturated fat to some extent, but increases the amount of calcium in the diet and increases the amount of potassium in the diet. And that diet, called the DASH diet, can be a first step in the management of slight to moderate elevations of blood pressure and can sometimes make it possible, when combined with, you know, some weight loss, that medication can be discontinued or at least decreased and blood pressure still maintained. So diet is also important, not simply salt restriction, which is what most people think, not simply salt restriction, although that does work for some, but also this type of DASH diet can be very effective in improving your blood pressure.
Once again, just in case it flew by somebody, the DASH diet?
The DASH diet is a diet of somewhat greater amount of potassium, some increased amount of calcium, restriction in saturated fat, without truly restricting sodium. It can still decrease your systolic and diastolic blood pressures, not by a tremendous amount, but by a sufficient amount many times to control blood pressure without medication or to use a weaker medication and still be able to achieve blood pressure control.
Tell me about the Framingham study. What do we learn from that?
Landmark. Framingham, of course, referring to Framingham, Massachusetts, where a population of folks over almost 40 plus years has been studied. In fact, they're now into the third generation. And Framingham was interesting in that what was looked at was called an observational study. What was looked at was what specific characteristics people had, that is their blood pressure, their cholesterol, etc., good, bad cholesterol, triglycerides, whether they smoked, what their lifestyles were like, and what happened to them. Did they have heart attacks or strokes over time? And what the Framingham study was able to show us was that LDL cholesterol was dangerous to one's cardiovascular health, that HDL cholesterol was beneficial to cardiovascular health. And indeed, in the current National Cholesterol Education Program guideline, doctors have been given a tremendously effective tool called the Framingham Risk Calculator. And anyone's who's out there, your doctor can calculate your risk over the next 10 years for having a heart attack simply by putting into this risk calculator these kind of issues, and can actually come up with a percent over 10 years of having a heart attack. Now, where this becomes most important, Alan, is the current guideline looks at people with multiple risks, and if they, on the basis of a Framingham risk calculation, have greater than a 20% 10-year risk of having a heart attack, those folks should be treated just like someone who has had a heart attack.
Do we treat people who have had heart attacks in a way that we ought to, in general, be treating everybody as? In other words, you know, you take a statin if you've had a heart attack or one of those drugs.
Sure.
So what I'm asking
is, are they treated differently?
No, I think what I mean here is, are we treating people who haven't had a heart attack appropriately? Some people say the healthiest people in the world are sick people because all of a sudden they start to take care of themselves. Are we doing the same thing for those who have not had an incident?
Well, the answer is no. And that's in part because some of the interventions that we use in a high-risk person have some risk associated with them. And therefore, you wouldn't want to subject someone with very low risk to those same type of medications and interventions, aspirin, for example, being, probably the premier example. I think that what medicine is trying to do is find the heart attack waiting to happen. We already know that people with a heart attack are at the highest risk in the general population for having another heart attack. And therefore, those people require very aggressive medication and lifestyle change. People who have diabetes are equivalent in risk to individuals who've already had a heart attack. Even if they've never had a heart attack or don't have any heart disease, they are at equivalent risk and need to be treated to the same aggressive targets. That's new in the new guideline. Additionally, using the Framingham risk calculator, we can find people who don't have diabetes, who don't have any sort of prior heart attack, who are at such high risk that for all intents and purposes, they're like someone who had a heart attack. those folks are the ones that we try and find, the heart attack waiting to happen. Those are the folks for whom very aggressive management with medication, lifestyle change makes sense, saves them a bad outcome, a heart attack, a stroke. And that's what medicine is trying to do. Medicine is trying to find those folks and help those folks to get their risk down.
Paul Lemansky, my father died at 74. Other people's fathers die at 100. There seems to be this genetic predictability that somebody whose father lived a longer time, you have a better chance of living a longer time. But some of our fathers, for example mine, smoked a lot. Does this make a big difference in terms of the predictability of, as you're talking
about,
Framingham?
The world is a very complicated place. And I always hear patients come in and say, you know, that they're betting the farm on the fact that their dad lived to be 99 and that their mom lived to be, you know, 102. Unfortunately, we can't do that anymore. And we can't do it for several reasons. Yes, I mean, it's certainly better than if your father had a heart attack at age 41. But I wouldn't necessarily think that one could just do things that are known to be detrimental to the cardiovascular system simply because your parents lived to a ripe old age. And part of the reason is that the diets that we consume now are different than the diets our parents grew up on. Perhaps their body weights were different. You know, we have a very high stress environment that we live in normally. And, you know, while it's difficult to measure, there's a lot of us that believe that that level of stress contributes in some way. Mm. Stress is difficult to measure, so it's difficult to prove.
Has anybody attempted to? Has anybody done?
Oh, sure. There are people that are attempting to do it all the time.
It's so just that you have your Framingham, you know, your guideline, and you can put in your numbers. I take it if you put in stress and somebody was able to ascertain stress, even though it's subjective, you could probably figure something out.
You would be able probably to further risk stratify. You know, and there's been talk about certain personality types that have increased cardiovascular disease. It's proven to be a very, very difficult issue to really get your arms around. And it's much more easy to get your arms around cholesterol, body weight, these kind of things. And since we know those things dramatically improve one's risk, those are the ones that we've focused on so far. I'm sure in the future, with more sophisticated types of tests, we'll be able to identify not only genetic predisposition better, but we'll also be able to identify behavior that contributes adversely to cardiovascular disease.
Okay, now let's have a discussion of our discussion up until here. I'm going to ask you, Dr. Paul Lemansky, to tell us what we should eat every day. So let me see if I can start. I'm going to take my aspirin, although you warned me about the contraindications.
Yeah.
I'm going to take fish oil every day.
Well, now this is an interesting issue. I would say, Alan, and again, this is going back, and this is a common theme, what I generally tell patients. If we can consume those things in the natural product, in the natural state, that's the superior way of taking it. So we do know, for example, that fish consumption is beneficial for the heart. There are several studies out within the last year to 18 months that prove that fish oil consumption can reduce cardiovascular death and disease. That being said, generally speaking, if one were to have an elevation of their triglyceride, it would be the type of thing you could bring up with your clinician that, should I be on fish oil? I think that's an absolute reasonable thing to ask. If someone wanted to take fish oil, the best way to do it is to eat fish. So I have, you know, what we call SMASH, salmon and mackerel and anchovies, if you don't have high blood pressure, I guess, because it's high in salt, and sardines and herring. Those fish, those fatty fish, should be consumed, and this is not me speaking, this is American Heart Association speaking, you know, 3 days a week, if you can.
I do.
And doing so has benefit. Now, let's say you can't stand fish.
Learn to like it.
If you can't stand fish, does that make a case for fish oil? Well, I guess it could. All right. As a general rule, I prefer a patient eating fish rather than taking fish oil. Fish oil should really be used as a pharmacologic agent by a clinician, not just as a supplement by someone wanting to pop, you know, pills and to reduce their risk by taking their fish oil capsules while at the same time going to, you know, eat a high-fat meal. I don't think that's necessarily going to be shown to be helpful. Fish oil, though, is something that, for our listeners, can be beneficial to reduce triglycerides and reduce cardiovascular death, and it should be something discussed with your doctor, because there are some issues regarding people on anticoagulants, etc. The issue needs to be addressed and with a clinician.
Green leaf vegetables.
You know, we all like to tell patients, we want you to eat 5 helpings of fruits and vegetables a day. I like to turn that around and say, we want you to eat 5 helpings of vegetables and fruit, rather than fruit and vegetables, vegetables and fruit, because it's much easier to eat fruit because fruit is sweet, and Americans are addicted to sweets. It is not, however, get us the benefit to eat tons of fruit. If diabetic patients eat lots of fruit, their blood sugars go up. Their blood sugars go up, their cardiovascular risk goes up. We need to eat more vegetables. And, you know, yes, I would say 4 helpings of vegetables and 1 helping of fruit, and that sounds reasonable to me. To do that on a daily basis is extremely important. It's not the type of thing that Americans generally do, but it is the type of thing that gives them tremendous benefit. The fats that we consume, if we can eat the fats as we talked about before, olive oil and canola oil as our main fat sources, that will give us benefit.
Because there you get your alpha-linolenic?
Alpha-linolenic acid is the omega-3 fatty acid in canola oil. It's also to some extent in soybean oil, although to a smaller extent. It's to a much larger extent in flaxseed oil.
So, if you didn't have a rough enough time of it, we're losing weight. Some of us are taking aspirin. We're doing fish. We're doing vegetables. We're staying away from meat except on an exceptional basis. We're trying to stay away from fats. And we're doing exercise. Mm-hmm. And that is probably the best set of predictors. Now, with intervention, we may have our niacin to bring up our HDL. Mm-hmm. Is that a lifelong thing, by the way, or is it something? It is.
Yes.
Once you start it, you're doing it.
Well, let's put it this way. If you have a need to start it, that need generally doesn't go away unless you do something different, like lose weight, for example, which will also raise your HDL. So,
and if we're taking a statin, as I remember what you've said today, and we're doing niacin, preliminary studies are indicating that we better be careful about the other vitamins that we are taking, because there are some indications that this is...
That antioxidants might not be beneficial under those circumstances. Yep, that's correct.
Well, this has been a wonderful gift to all of us, Paul. And I really want to thank you, because we know a lot more than we used to know, and we can save our lives. And if we do these kinds of things and we pay attention, then if we love somebody, we'll get them to do it also. You're a thin guy. You're obviously following your own diet. And I guess the question is to everybody who's listening, is it worth it? Don't smoke, among other things.
I think it's very worth it. And here's what I would say to you, Alan, just in the last few moments. If someone were to have a heart attack and die, that's not necessarily the worst way to die. So some folks have said to me, well, you got to die of something, doc. You know, why do you want to do all these things? Well, I would point out to them that the process of plaque deposition, this atherosclerotic process that we're so concerned about all the time, that process goes on in not only the heart arteries, but also in the carotids and the brain arteries. You don't want to spend the last 10 years of your life in a nursing home with a stroke. So as a motivator, you know, you want to improve your lifestyle and make sure that your cardiovascular risk is reduced. Think about the issue of spending the last 10 years of one's life in a nursing home when you could be out there, you know, engaging in the world and doing all the things that people like to do.
Thank you, Dr. Paul Lemansky, the director of the Center for Preventive Medicine, Albany Associates in Cardiology, and Prime Care Physicians.
Thank you, Alan.